Blog Talk Radio. Okay, and we're back. We're going down to South Africa. There's a lot going on down there, as is always the case. We continue to try and cover it as we are able. And over the many years, the man who has been down there for us, our man in South Africa, who was born in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and who has contributed mightily to our understanding of what's going on in South Africa, one of the least understood major countries really on the planet, is Jan Lamprecht. And there was a political assassination carried out there against a man who was in that country a legend in his own time. He was a white man. We're going to find out about that, what's behind it, what it was designed to perhaps do, what may be coming now, what may not be coming. But just to keep the thing in round numbers, there are about 40 million blacks in South Africa, about 4 million whites. Quite a disparity. Let's call it 10 to 1. The whites, of course, have been in sub-Saharan Africa for, I'm not sure, I think it's at least 350 years, a long, long time. And there's a lot of history there, which is very, very important to understand. That's not to excuse the certainly the viciousness and evils of some of the apartheid government behaviors when the whites were in complete control of South Africa. No one's here to do that. But there are other issues on the other side of the coin. The black communist ANC government there has been certainly involved in some heinous criminal endeavors over the years. In point of fact, when we talk about criminal endeavors and crime, South Africa has an astronomically high crime rate. Things are literally out of control there. The murders of thousands of white Afrikaner farm families, men, women, and children, not just the murder, but the torture murders of these people, has been something the world will not confront or look at. We've covered it here. It is a hideous, hideous situation. The word we now have from Jan is that the chief of security or intelligence for South Africa apparently said to the Mugabe regime in Zimbabwe that the white farms in South Africa are all going to be taken, just like they were in Zimbabwe. We'll find out. Time will tell. But first, let's welcome Jan Lamprecht back to the program tonight. Hello, my friend. How are you doing?
Hi there, Jeff. I'm fine, thanks.
Good.
Glad to be on your show again.
Good. I tried to give some basic rudimentary ideas of background so we'll know where we're going to go. But I think you might mention, first of all, the murder which took place. Then we might stop there and pause there and go back to the beginning, when that part of the world had very, very few human inhabitants. And when Europeans moved down to colonize, it was not as if they moved into a richly and thickly populated area of the world and took it over. It's a very interesting story, and please go ahead.
Yeah, Jeff, the history of South Africa is very complicated. Basically, in terms of the people who moved into the region, white people actually came to South Africa and came to the Cape before black people. But there were other inhabitants in the area. They were known as the Khoi. And these people were not a black people, because, you know, Africa is not just black. There are also other races of people. And there have been fights between blacks and other races. The people that we know as the Bushmen or the San were actually inhabiting parts of southern Africa long before black people came here. Black people migrated here from the north, from central Africa, and the black people actually murdered and drove the San people to the south. And so what happened was white people actually ended up in the Cape among these San people before the black people arrived. And the whites and the blacks met in what is now the Eastern Cape at a place called the Great Fish River. And that is the beginning of the meeting between blacks and whites and their clashes and the rich history that started from that point.
Mm-hmm.
But now, in terms of whites who came to South Africa, whites came here in about 1652. The whites have been here a long time. In the case of this particular guy who was murdered, Eugene Terblanche, whom we'll discuss, Terblanche, you'll notice from his name, is actually a French name. And the Afrikaner population is actually made up of not just Dutch and German. There's actually a large segment of the Afrikaner population that came from the French Huguenots who left France.
Mm-hmm.
So in his particular case, his family tree goes back to 1704. So white people have lived in South Africa for as long as white people have been living in America. And yeah, there's quite a deep history that goes back.
Yeah, his name is Terrebalanche, I believe, which
yes.
I think Terre Blanche might be white earth or something like that.
Exactly. You've got it. You're dead on the money. Yes, that's exactly what his name means.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, the Afrikaners come from a bit of a mishmash of Western European stock. But I mean, you white Americans come from, I think, Western and Eastern European stock. So, you know, same descendants, really.
Got it. Okay, very good. Now, we have also talked about, over the years, HIV/AIDS. We'll talk about that in our conversation tonight as well. You don't hear about it in the States anymore. It's almost as if it's gone away. It hasn't. We have a crime rate that is it defies description. We have any white female, literally, who exposes herself in public, unless she's surrounded by some very strong protection, is an immediate target. There are roving gangs looking for whites all the time to mug, to rob, to rape, and worse. And it happens continually. Another story we do not hear about here in the States, unless I cover it, and Jan has been very good to send me from time to time some of the worst, and they are hideous. The crime rate in South Africa does not seem to be something that can be effectively addressed by anyone, quite frankly. It is completely out of control.
You know, Jeff, crime, we are so used to crime now that we don't even think about the fact that it's out of control.
Wow.
We just know that you must just be careful of this, be careful of that. You know, there are lots of people in this country, for example, who don't drive at night. It's just a given. They just don't go out anymore. You know, in the last 30 years, in the time that I've been in South Africa, I've seen South Africa change so much. I think it will be interesting to compare your country, when I pop around there later this year for a visit, to compare your country with South Africa at night. Because I remember when I traveled to Holland a couple of years ago, I was absolutely amazed. You know, I found myself in Amsterdam, which is the most violent, crime-ridden city in Europe. And when I was in Amsterdam, we were out there, we were having dinner at midnight. People were walking back to their hotels in the center of Amsterdam after midnight. And I remember one woman said, well, she's going to go off to the train station. And all these people were telling us that, you know, this is like the most dangerous place in Holland.
Wow.
And here was this white woman, and she was off to walk to the train station at midnight. And you know, they were doing that. In South Africa, if you travel around South Africa's cities at night, I can tell you that restaurants in South Africa start closing their doors at 8 p.m. in the evening. And there is hardly any nightlife after 8 p.m. in the evening. And when I came to this country, people were partying until 5 o'clock the next morning, coming home at any time of the night. You know, crime has changed the way people live. And it's been like this for a long time. And people are now so used to it. And I think people outside the country don't appreciate some of these things. So people know how to avoid things. Another thing at night, I don't know if you know this, is that a lot of people don't even stop at traffic lights.
Especially the white drivers, right?
Hey, Jeff, even black people don't stop at traffic lights at night.
It's that dangerous. Wow.
It's that dangerous. I'm probably the only guy who drives around at, or one of the few who drives around at night and actually observes the traffic rules of the road.
So it's just rolling stops, if that, and you keep moving. Because I've talked to you in the past. Didn't we have someone on who described coming, even leaving their garage, opening the garage
yeah.
door, and moving out into their driveway was dangerous?
That was a lady who was a co-worker of mine. Yeah, Jeff, people get attacked when you leave home or you come back from home.
Unbelievable.
That's also a given.
Well, it's another bonus of the communist regime of the government of the ANC in South Africa. Back in just a minute with Jan Lamprecht, live from South Africa. Welcome back. Talking with our colleague Jan Lamprecht in South Africa about the situation down there. It is an historic one. What has happened there has been nothing but bad since the apartheid regime was overthrown. Not that that was good, but we go from one extreme, it seems, to the other. And the other right now is pointing in a particularly hideous direction vis-a-vis the minority, and I mean capital M, white population. All right, Jan, go ahead, please.
Yeah. Jeff, to just go on, I think we need to discuss the Afrikaner history and just where the Afrikaners actually come from and why they did what they did.
And why the English and Lord Kitchener destroyed them.
You know, because South Africa's history is quite brutal and interesting. You know, I must tell you, when I read South African history, I have a little book here. It's called Battles of South Africa. And it was compiled by a university professor about all the little-known battles of South Africa, not the major ones, but all strange little battles that have occurred in its history that have been forgotten. You know, South Africa's got such a broad and rich history in Southern Africa that you almost cannot even begin to fathom it, because I suppose America, in many ways, South Africa for its small size has a history that's almost as rich as some of the history that exists in your country, because there were so many different peoples involved with all sorts of strange backgrounds. And you know, it's just been a very active place in the past. And there is history that goes back 200 and 300 years that modern South Africans have almost completely forgotten. And some of it has parallels. For example, I must just tell you a little bit. During the early days when whites and blacks were clashing in the Eastern Cape, mm-hmm. there were a series of wars that very little is, you hardly hear it mentioned, but these wars were called the Kaffir Wars or the Frontier Wars. And in those wars, in those days, white farmers were coming under attack from blacks. And this was like 200 years ago. And these white farmers were building almost little forts. They were turning their houses into like little forts. And they had holes in the walls from which they could fire their muskets. And I was reading about this and I thought to myself, goodness me, you know, it's almost, whatever, 200 years later, and we're still back in the same situation, you know, a handful of farmers fighting off people attacking their land. And out of all these problems, where the Afrikaner really comes into the picture is that you must remember a lot of the whites who came to Africa, you had your British colonials, and in the Cape as well, you also had the situation where the Cape itself, because of its strategic value, flip-flopped between different powers that controlled it. The the British controlled it at a certain point. The Dutch controlled it. I think even the French controlled it at a point. And in the Cape Colony was really the place where the initial white immigrants came to the country. But a lot of those people who also came in order to get away from Europe. And those people later on didn't like British rule. And those people started trying to move out of the Cape. And that is where the Great Trek comes from. And that was the beginning of what we now call the Afrikaners.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who wanted to get away from British rule. What is a little known fact is that even though many Afrikaners left the Cape Colony and moved into the interior of South Africa, about 60% of Afrikaners at the time of the last Boer War, about 60% of Afrikaners actually still lived under British rule. But the others who left, they were the ones who started founding new countries, and they went into the interior of South Africa. Now, the blacks, in terms of where they were located, the blacks were not located in the interior. The majority of the black population actually lived down the east coast of South Africa. Now, let me just say that the west coast of South Africa is largely desert, but the east coast of South Africa is actually very fertile and very green, mm-hmm. and has a high rainfall.
Hmm.
And the blacks, the Zulus, lived down the eastern coast of South Africa. And this is where the majority of the black population was. The Zulus had wars with other black people in the interior of South Africa. And during these wars, they actually exterminated. It was a literal genocide. They absolutely wiped out the blacks who lived in the interior of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And how it came to be that the Afrikaners ended up in the center of South Africa was that Afrikaners, when they were starting to look for territory to move into, they sent scouts out and they went into the interior, and these scouts discovered that the interior of South Africa is largely uninhabited as a result of these black-on-black wars. And that was how these whites then started what is known as the Great Trek.
Hmm.
And they moved into the interior and they started occupying this land. Now, the Afrikaner history is actually an interesting history of constant rebellion. And it's, in that sense, it's similar to American history.
That's interesting. Again, we're learning a lot already. Be right back with Jan in just a couple of minutes, talking about a country that sits now really on the doorstep of some potentially catastrophic developments, predicated on the assassination of a very, very well-known, legendary white figure in South Africa. Back in just a minute. We're back with Jan and talking about very much misunderstood, very promising, but very troubled country, South Africa. Okay, go ahead, Jan, please.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, the Afrikaners who started off wanting to have their own country were a lot of small independent outfits, and you had individual leaders with a couple of followers, and they dashed off here and they dashed off there. We tend to remember the Afrikaners as having had two Afrikaner republics, But in actual fact is there was actually several more. In Pretoria, they have a thing called the Monument, and the Monument is a huge structure that was built in remembrance of the Boer victory over the Zulus at the Battle of Blood River. And in this monument, if you go inside it, they actually have a lot of the history of the Afrikaner, and they have the flags and the details of the various countries that the Afrikaners actually created. And I can't remember if it's about 5 or 6 different Afrikaner states that were founded in different parts of South Africa. But some of these states were very small and they didn't last very long. You know, some of them lasted anything from 2 years to 6 years. And they had all these different little republics. Most of them fell away. The two that ended up surviving was the one called the Transvaal and the other one called the Orange Free State. And these ones were founded around about the 1830s at the time of the Great Trek. And the Afrikaners quietly occupied the center of South Africa, and nobody really bothered much with them. The British had their colonies along the coast, the one being the Cape Colony, and later on the British colonized Natal.
Mm-hmm.
And in the ensuing decades, the Afrikaners developed and built up their countries, and they were doing fine. But then what happened was, at a point, the British tried to annex the one republic, it's the Transvaal. I don't know of the actual reason why the British suddenly decided to annex it. And the way they did it was actually quite funny. The British just sent a contingent of policemen, a couple of hundred policemen, and they sent these policemen up to Pretoria, and they literally just took over the place.
Huh.
But during this time, the Afrikaners then started resisting it. And this came to be known as the First Anglo-Boer War. And during this, the Afrikaners actually ended up, the Boers ended up having a shootout with the British, and they actually defeated the British. And they ended up retaining control of the Transvaal. And all was quite peaceful for another 20 years. And then came the thing which really changed the history of South Africa, and that was the discovery of gold. And gold was discovered here in Johannesburg. And because gold, I suppose the world was more on a gold standard in those days.
Right.
These days, who cares, mm-hmm. Hey?
Yeah, exactly.
They just invent money.
Why worry about it? Just keep pushing computer keys and creating money.
Yeah, just inventing it out of thin air. And we're all going to die in poverty.
Yep.
And so what happened when they discovered large amounts of gold here in Johannesburg? That really became an issue, because then South Africa became almost the money supply of the world. And that was actually the thing that really started drawing interest, because then mines started coming, investors started coming, non-Afrikaners started moving into this country. And that was when South Africa became a sort of a cosmopolitan area. So even though the Afrikaners had been here in the beginning, the discovery of gold started changing the demographics and started changing all sorts of things. Now, the Afrikaners at a point were actually quite ambitious, and the Afrikaners wanted to expand in all sorts of directions, actually. The Afrikaners wanted to expand westwards. Others wanted to expand northwards. This was sort of the peak of Afrikaner existence. They were free. They were able to think all kinds of thoughts, and they were dominant. And they were becoming more and more dominant, and starting to drive out the black tribes. You know, because of their structure and the strength of their countries,
sure.
The blacks were becoming almost irrelevant, because these groups of whites, they were building a white country in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And they now had the funds and the structure to do all sorts of things. And they were now actually starting to challenge the British Empire, because the British had a lot of power in the region, but now the Afrikaners were threatening to become the dominant power. And if you read the history of the Second Anglo-Boer War, and that's the war that's the Boer War that most people are familiar with. If you read the history of that, you'll see that right up front, I think it was Kitchener, but it was one of the British planners of the war. They stated up front that the real issue here is going to be a clash between dominance in the region. And there were a lot of high-ranking British politicians and strategists at the time who said that, you know, they have to nip these Afrikaners in the bud now, because if they don't do this, then the Afrikaners will become the dominant force in Southern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And the Afrikaners were well on their way to achieving that. So a lot of things then conspired, along with this gold, into forcing the British to decide that the time has come. They can't leave these people alone. They need to grab hold of their state. And initially, I think the war was initially declared against the Transvaal, but then, because that's where the gold was. But then what happened was the Free State had a sort of alliance. I won't say an alliance, but the Free State then joined the Transvaal, and they both decided to resist the British attack.
Right.
And that was how the Boer War got going. But in the beginning, the Boer War was a conventional war, and the Boers at the time actually managed to field quite an amazing number of troops. They actually had an army of about 60,000 troops, and they had bought modern weaponry from Germany.
Huh.
Yeah.
60,000, that is a formidable number.
Yeah.
Indeed. Fascinating look at history with Jan Lamprecht. We'll continue our conversation with Jan in just a couple of minutes. Stay there. Our conversation, we're moving toward the issue of apartheid and how that came about.
Yeah.
It's all a very interesting story, and virtually no one over here understands it. Let's hear more, Jan.
Well, Jeff, I think the creation of apartheid is probably one of the most interesting stories in South African history, and you need to understand all these things that I've discussed with you in order to fully appreciate what actually happened and why it happened. Once the war started, the war was from 1900 to 1902, but the actual Afrikaner combatability in the field, their ability to field conventional armies,
mm-hmm.
Wasn't quite that good in the beginning. They had a very loose system where people sort of volunteered and came and fought. And then if a guy lost interest, then he just packed his bags and went home. And so it wasn't the kind of military structure that you're used to. But nevertheless, these guys fielded about 60,000 troops, and they had several armies, and they fought on two fronts. And the British mobilized. One of the things that commentators at the time expected was they expected the great British Empire to just come and just walk over these bunch of sort of backward white farmers and just wipe the floor with them, and that's the end of it. But the Boer War actually was probably what you could call perhaps even the first liberation war that later on affected the British Empire itself, because the Afrikaner resistance was far, far greater than anybody anticipated. the conventional war started out with the British attacking on two fronts. They attacked from the south, and then they attacked from the east. And the British started pouring in troops. At the height of the Boer War, the British had 250,000 troops in South Africa.
Wow.
And they were calling, and they were bringing in troops from Australia and New Zealand in order to beat these Afrikaners. They needed vast numbers of troops in order to actually crush the Afrikaner. The Afrikaners fought a number of big battles, and some of the battles were very successful. And in these battles, let me just tell you an error about the Afrikaners. A lot of the Afrikaner leaders at the start of the war were leaders who were accustomed to fighting black tribes. And when I visited the late President P.W. Botha, he actually told me that in his opinion, the start of the war was a disaster for the Afrikaner, because you had all these guys running the army and they were used to fighting the black tribes. And they were used to the tactics of fighting the black tribe.
I see.
And now they were up against the conventional First World Army.
Right.
So a lot of the Boer generals weren't professional military men, and they weren't that good. And when they were facing normal conventional warfare methods, they actually flopped. But there were a couple like De La Rey, who became a legend. De La Rey, to this day, is a legend among Afrikaners. And there's a lesser-known general who, in my opinion, was absolutely brilliant. His name was General De Wet. Later on, even the Russians studied his tactics. And then there was Smuts as well. But as some of these older generals flopped and flunked out, there were these other guys who were starting to come to the fore. And as the Afrikaner resistance started collapsing and their armies started melting away, the conventional war lasted about 6 months. And then the British were on the advance, and Afrikaner resistance was collapsing. But it was these guys who survived that, who then took the war into the guerrilla phase. And it was them who became the stuff of legend and who really fought the war that people now have come to know the Afrikaner for. What happened was the British were now fighting. After the collapse of the conventional attack, of the conventional front, the British were now fighting a kind of insurgency. And what the British did was they started burning farms, because they realized that the Afrikaners were now mobile. They were mobile and they were moving around in the same way that you see in Iraq and Vietnam and all
sure.
those places.
Sure.
The Afrikaners are now moving around. And the British then decided that they need to destroy their sort of base. And the base that they saw was their farm. So the British came and they burned their farms to the ground. They rounded up their women and children and chucked them in concentration camps.
They
called them that.
Yep.
And later on, a particular point of bitterness among Afrikaners became the issue that so many of their women and children died in these concentration camps. The women, despite their situation, still egged their men on. They actually said to the men that the men must carry on fighting. So the war became a complete guerrilla war. What they did in South Africa was the British ended up in the same situation that the Americans are in Iraq and so forth, where they now have to occupy the whole country, but these groups are moving around. Incidentally, a lot of people will tell you that South Africa is great terrain for guerrilla warfare.
Uh-huh.
I've lived here and I've seen the place, and I'm telling you, it's a really rotten place for guerrilla warfare, because South Africa is actually flat, there's no place to really hide, and it's actually amazing that the Afrikaners pulled off their guerrilla tactics, because even when the blacks later on wanted to wage guerrilla warfare in South Africa, the blacks found it impossible to do so. They actually could not fight the same sort of guerrilla warfare that you see in Vietnam and Rhodesia. They actually had to operate in the cities, because that was the only place they could hide. But the Afrikaners were able to fight a guerrilla warfare in this open, miserable place. Then when the defeat of the the Afrikaners fought and they pulled off a whole bunch of quite spectacular things. And they fought and fought until eventually the whole country was occupied and there was no place left to fight. And then finally they surrendered. After the war, and this is where things now become interesting, the British now dominated all of South Africa because South Africa actually had been four different countries. It had been two Afrikaner countries and two British colonies. So the British took these four entities and molded them into one, and they called this now South Africa. And the British then tried to actually sort of make peace with the Afrikaners and tried to smooth things over. Mm-hmm. And there was a period of time where some Afrikaners did become friendly to the British, but there were others who hated the British from there onward, and who then tended towards supporting Germany. What happened after that was complicated by the fact that you had World War I and World War II. In both World Wars, the Afrikaners were divided almost down the middle as to whether they should support the British or should support the Germans. And they weren't interested so much in Nazism as the fact that they hated the British for what the British had done to them.
Oh, sure.
Now, I must tell you another aspect of South African history that people completely forget about, and they smooth this over. And I even had my parents and my uncles used to tell me about this aspect of South African history. After the British won the war, the British came to dominate South Africa. And the British dominated the economy of South Africa. And what is not appreciated is the fact that the Afrikaner found himself to be a second-rate citizen in a country where he formerly had ruled.
Mm.
The Afrikaners were discriminated against by the English-speaking South Africans, most of them of British descent. And this became another point of bitterness for the Afrikaner. Afrikaners, Jeff, were prevented from occupying certain positions, getting certain jobs, all sorts of things. This was in the decades after the Boer War.
Who got the jobs?
What's that?
Who got the jobs?
The English-speaking people.
Gave it to the
South Africa's population, white population makeup, mm-hmm. even to this day, is about 60% Afrikaans, 40% English speaking. And they tend to differentiate between these two groups because the Afrikaners are more conservative and the English speakers are more liberal.
We're talking about whites.
Whites, mm-hmm. exactly.
Right.
And these British English-speaking people were dominating the country because at that point in time, the country was still, elections were still for whites only. Even though the British were running the show, the British weren't letting the blacks in. The blacks still counted for nothing, even mm-hmm. under British rule.
Mm-hmm.
So then it became the issue of the whites among themselves and how they were ruling the country, and the British were dominating it. And the British dominance was especially strong in industry. And it was in industry where they were deciding who to give jobs to. They were giving jobs even at a point to blacks rather than Afrikaners and so forth. And it was when the Afrikaners found themselves in this situation that you get a special little group of Afrikaners. The term for them is the bitter einders, which can be translated as the bitter enders, the guys who, despite having lost everything, refused to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was these handful of bitter einders who then got together and they started making plans. And, Jeff, if people tell you that conspiracies don't work, conspiracies are real, they work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the greatest conspiracies in history is the conspiracy called the Afrikaner Broederbond. And Broederbond is brotherhood. And what these Afrikaners decided to do, having
hold,
lost
hold
the
on,
war...
Hold on, Jan,
and,
right there, would you please?
Okay.
This is a good place to stop. So, this is unprecedented, really. A history of South Africa in terms you can understand. And we'll see where it goes next with Jan in just a couple minutes. Hang on. Welcome back. Our second hour with Jan Lomprecht. We're learning an awful lot about the history of South Africa. And if you want to understand a country's current configuration, you've got to understand its past. And you'll never get a better, more easily understandable summation than we have heard already from Jan tonight. We're moving toward how apartheid came into being and then the murder of Eugene Terblanche and what that has to do with the right wing and the Afrikaners, and the future of whites in South Africa. Okay, Jan?
Yeah. Okay. Just to mention one thing. Even though the Afrikaners lost the Boer War, the fact of the matter was the European powers were completely stunned that a bunch of farmers in a backward country could take on the whole British Empire and do so for 2 years. And that, in many ways, that was the beginning of the end of the British Empire. I remember my mentor, Dr. Chris Jordan, he said to me that if you actually study history, you can actually come up with an almost, you know, one interpretation can be that the beginning of the end of the British Empire was the Anglo-Boer War, because that caused Britain to lose so much credibility. And later on, you had all sorts of tribes in other parts of the British Empire who started rebelling against the British because people saw what the Afrikaners had done. And incidentally, there are a couple of great books about the Boer War written by Afrikaners who were there. And my personal favorite is The 3 Years' War by General de Wet. This book had such importance that even the Russian military studied it during World War II.
Yeah, very interesting.
Their efforts to fight the Germans.
Huh.
But anyway, going back to what happened in the 1920s and 30s, when the Afrikaners found themselves in a situation where the English-speaking whites were dominating them, they decided to fight back, and they formed the secret society called the Broederbond. And it was basically the Afrikaner intellectual group. They would work as a team, and they would fight their way forward, and they would do so clandestinely. And what the Broederbond did was the Broederbond then started infiltrating organizations. They created lots of organizations. They created cultural organizations, and they went so far that anything that had any English organization that existed, they created the Afrikaner version of the same thing. So, for example, if you had the Boy Scouts, then the Afrikaners created the Voortrekkers and so forth. And the Afrikaners ensured that for every organization that existed, that they had their equivalent, and then they started supporting their equivalent. The other thing they did was they infiltrated organizations and took them over. And interestingly enough, this is the same strategy that the blacks later used themselves when the communists taught them how to infiltrate organizations and take them over.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is the Afrikaners also created many organizations from scratch. They created lots of organizations in the 1930s at the height of the Depression. Those organizations exist to this day. But those organizations are no longer dominated by them.
Huh.
So the Afrikaners then had this policy that if one Afrikaner got into an organization, he would try to promote another Afrikaner.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys started moving their way up and started creating and changing their own people so that they could actually gain political power. And their ultimate goal was to now actually seize political control of South Africa. And, Jeff, it didn't take them long. I think the original conspiracy started in about the 1920s or thereabouts.
Uh-huh.
And in 1948, the Afrikaners also created their own political party that would now be the tool they would use.
Right.
In the same way that the blacks created the ANC, the Afrikaners created the National Party, the NP.
Hmm.
And the National Party was the thing that they pushed. And they even managed to get white English-speaking people to vote for the National Party. And that was how apartheid came into being.
Mm-hmm.
And they won the general election in 1948, and that was when apartheid was created. So apartheid was the result. If you sit back and you look at history, apartheid was actually a strange result of the Afrikaners losing the Boer War. They lost the war. They lost their countries. The British came and created this larger structure, which included British colonies and their former territory.
Mm-hmm.
And the British did not want the Afrikaners to have their own country. They forced them now to be part of a larger country, and the Afrikaners decided to take over the larger country. And that was how apartheid came into being. They now managed to get to the top, and then they were now forced into the structure where they couldn't rule themselves, but they now had to rule other people, and that was apartheid. And so then, as a result of this, the Afrikaners always wanted to just have their own country. This is the basic Afrikaner ambition. But when they were forced into a situation where they now had to coexist with other people they didn't want to coexist with, they then started separating things and breaking things up so that you had Afrikaner and you had others. And then, of course, they also broke things up along racial lines where they went and said, okay, this is whites, that's blacks. But
Jan,
this is the whites and that's the blacks,
yeah,
that is how it had always been under the British system.
I see. So it carried forward. Let me ask you a question. How many of the English-speaking non-Boer, non-Afrikaners, came to support the Boers, the Afrikaners, in apartheid?
Now I'm going to shock you. You will have heard the name of Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd.
Mm-hmm.
He was the Prime Minister of South Africa at the height of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will tell you that when this guy, and he was assassinated, there were two attempts on his life, and he was ultimately killed. He was first shot, and he survived that, and later on he was stabbed. He was stabbed by a Greek communist called Stafendes. Anyway, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, I will tell you, was the Ian Smith of South Africa. In history and in modern reinterpretations of that time, mm-hmm. they will tell you this guy was the worst of the whites. In actual fact, he was the best of the whites. Verwoerd was a really brilliant man. And he also united the whites of South Africa like they've never been united before or since. And at the height of apartheid, English-speaking whites in vast numbers supported this guy as well. And that is why this guy had to be killed, because this guy united the whites like they'd never been united. This was done by the 1960s. Let me tell you something. Apartheid was a tremendous success in the same way that Hitler was a tremendous success. You know, if you look at history and you look at the communists, you will see that when the communists took over Russia, the communists killed most of the military officers. They starved most of the farmers to death.
Sure.
You know, the country was actually a hellhole.
Right.
If you look at Hitler, you'll see that when Hitler ran Germany was actually extremely successful. there are lots of things in Germany that were created during the time of Hitler. Everything from the Autobahn to the Volkswagen. And people also don't know that Hitler was extremely, he had an extremely successful agricultural policy.
And now, a public health program. He had a national public health program, anti-smoking. He had a tremendous, there's been a book written about Hitler's public health war on cancer, which was really the world's first. So, yes, there were some things that the populace benefited from, and the fact that he was able to literally pull the country from the garbage pen of nations and put it on top industrially. And that's one of the reasons that Germany had to be taken down twice by the English and French and others, because the German industrial scientific machine was literally walking away from the British, who were pretty much ruling the seas and not doing land kinds of brilliance, which in turn built a stable commodity and an incredible economy. A lot of things happen in Germany that are not understood now.
Jeff, you are completely correct. In its day, Germany was the number one. Germany occupied the position that America occupies today. It was the leading scientific nation of its day. Its engineering was right at the top. And the same sort of situation was occurring in South Africa. And, you know, we're entering this strange world, Jeff. You know, ultimately the world is ruled by nationalism. Ultimately people want to have something that's their own. And it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter whether you're a red Indian, or whether you're a German or an Afrikaner. You want something that's yours. And in the same way, the blacks have the same feelings. And I can understand that the blacks have their black nationalism. Everybody wants something that belongs to them.
That's right.
And if you look at these so-called radical right-wing whites, you'll see that they achieved incredible success when they had something that they believed was theirs. And they worked towards it, and there was a lot of energy that came out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. It's an incredibly strong motivation. Be right back with Jan Lamprecht, live from South Africa, in just a couple minutes. Okay, and back with Jan, and I guess if there's one thing we can take from this program, and there are many to be sure, but one is that we just don't understand history as it really was. The winners write the story, the losers are, shall we say, misrepresented, and there's so much more to the bigger picture than most people will ever understand. And what I mentioned about Germany in the 1930s is absolutely true. They were walking away from the English, just as they did at the turn of the century, which led to World War I. They were leaving the so-called civilized world in the dust. And that's one of the reasons they had to be taken down twice. So,
anyway. Jeff, on the subject of Germany, it is a bit of a digression. But I remember talking to people and you know, the conclusion was the Germans took on the whole world, and the Germans almost won. You know, and that tells you something about these people. And the joke is, Jeff, take a look at the history of Japan and take a look at the history of Germany. This is proof that when people are organized and they have the right sort of culture and the right sort of background, and they manage to get things done, you just can't keep a good man down. Look at how Germany and Japan, despite being absolutely smashed into the ground, are rising again.
All true, absolutely. All right, let's get back to our story about South Africa and moving up toward the murder of this very well-known, in fact, a legendary figure.
Now, Verwoerd is portrayed as the worst of the Afrikaner, but I'll tell you something. If people go and investigate history, the greatest leap forward in technology that South Africa ever experienced occurred under the direct rule of Verwoerd. All of South Africa's modern infrastructure, from its dams to its national highway system, you name it, was built during the era of Verwoerd. This is the guy that the blacks hate the most, but he's actually the guy who achieved the most out of anybody who's ever ruled this country in the last 350 years. Now, when Verwoerd died, Verwoerd was actually quite an intellectual, and apartheid itself is a very fascinating topic, and people who really want to understand apartheid should actually read books that were written by Afrikaner intellectuals. I'm talking professors and academics. They wrote books about apartheid before they did it. They wrote books and they studied apartheid, and they came up with this grand social engineering solution of how they saw the way future for South Africa, saw the way into the future for South Africa. And of course, the people who engineered apartheid were Afrikaners, and they wanted to ensure the survival of the Afrikaner, because I think the Afrikaner has been under attack. The British had been trying to take him down and so forth. So they were concerned for their future, and they were concerned for their future because of their small numbers versus the blacks. So apartheid was an interesting thing. Apartheid was actually nationalism. What they did was they decided to split up the country and to give part of the country back to the original black tribes who ran the country. But only parts of the country would go back to them. They obviously kept the best part for themselves.
Sure.
They kept the parts that had been the most developed.
Mm-hmm.
Is it ironic that the best part and the most developed part also happened to be the places where the whites had lived the longest and the most?
Mm.
You know, we can go into all that sort of story. The bottom line is they created these Bantustans, which were independent black states. And part of it was also an experiment in black self-rule. Part of apartheid actually wanted to hand territories back to the blacks and give them control of those territories and let them rule it. But that experiment was actually largely a failure. They had their own governments. They had their own constitutions. Most of them were corrupt. Some were better than others. Some did make a decent effort.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, the experiment in black self-rule was a failure. Where the ANC came into the picture was there were some blacks who went off to Russia, and they met up with Lenin, and they chatted to those guys, and that was where Russian intervention in South Africa actually started. And they started assisting the ANC through the Communist Party. And they then came up with a completely different set of ideas. Their ideas had nothing to do with nationalism. They wanted to take over the entire country. So now the blacks were trying to take over the whole country, and the whites were fighting for the whole country. And that actually led to the situation that we're in now. The Soviets at the time were busy sponsoring liberation movements across southern Africa,
sure,
and they were attacking in other places. And we saw their effects in Angola, in Zaire, in Rhodesia, in Mozambique, and so forth. So it was in that sort of era, the era of the liberation movement, that things started now changing a lot. And that was also when America, for the first time, started taking an interest in Africa. And America kind of wrote off, America in the late 50s already wrote off the white colonial governments in Africa. And the whites here were basically regarded as a liability. They were not seen as being capable of surviving in the long term. And so the West already started moving towards supporting the blacks right from the beginning. The British had no will to fight.
Right. The ratio was about the same then as it is now, 10 to 1?
Interestingly enough, do you know that in the past, if you go back about 80 years or so, the ratio was actually much better.
Huh.
You know that at one point the Afrikaner, the whites made up one third of South Africa's population?
No, now it's one tenth. All right,
now
we'll be right.
Tenth.
Or less than that, actually. Be right back with with Jan in just a few minutes. Remarkable walk through history. and we know it. The current times in which we live, and we'll get Jan's analysis of that and what we may expect next. Okay, and we're back with Jan. It's an amazing hour and a half already, and we're going to move into our last 30 now. We're up to current times now, which are clearly not headed in a good direction. And please continue, Jan, if you would.
Okay, Jeff. To understand the murder of Eugene Terblanche, which took place the other day, you have to understand a little bit of where this guy comes from. And this guy represents a certain kind of a debate. You know, as whites in Africa faced the growing power of black nationalism and the blacks being backed by the Chinese and the Russians, you know, whites looked at this situation and there was a lot of debate, and the debate ran for decades as to what should you do. You know, should you accommodate these people? Should you fight these people? Should you run away? Should you fight to the last man? That sort of thing. And in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, you had the rise of Ian Smith. The rise of Ian Smith was the result of them looking at Kenya, where the British were dealing with the blacks. And they saw how the blacks were murdering and torturing and mutilating the whites. And so then Rhodesia looked at this and they said, you know, we don't want this. We're going to fight this tooth and nail. And then what you had was, as Rhodesia's war started getting worse, you then had these Afrikaners looking at the situation and saying, you know, what are we going to do? Because this thing is coming down through Africa and it's coming to us. And this guy, Eugene Terblanche, he's seen as a joke and people mock him and they say, you know, he's like an Afrikaner Hitler and all that sort of thing. And yes, it's true. Eugene was anti-black. He said that, you know, we must fight these blacks to the last man and all that sort of thing. But if you also look at him, you'll also see that he was standing up for the Afrikaner and the Afrikaner right to rule himself. And this guy, at one point... He represented the hardcore of the whites, who at one point said, you know what, we mustn't give up the whole country, because now under apartheid, the whites controlled everything. So he said, don't give up this country, we mustn't give up the whole of South Africa. After South Africa had been taken over by the ANC, he changed his tune and he started saying, we must fight for an Afrikaner homeland. And that is what a lot of other, there are quite a few Afrikaners who've gone that route. And I mean, even myself, I believe in that as the next option or the option that people should try before they give up.
Jan, is that honestly not one of the first things I said to you as a non-Afrikaner, non-South African, just from a pragmatic standpoint, the solution would be separate homelands, one for the Afrikaner,
yeah.
And for the majority for the indigenous black population. That's common sense.
Jeff, hey, common sense is a
Yeah, I know.
Common.
Out the door, first thing. Yeah, goodbye.
Jeff, in that sense you're a visionary, my friend. You are a visionary. You have seen it, you know that it's the one way out. But I will tell you that from a globalist point of view, from the globalist point of view, whites should get the hell out of Africa. And the blacks love the idea. Not all the blacks, but the majority of those who support the ruling parties. They like the idea. Now, you've seen yourself, we've discussed Zimbabwe, and we've seen that the idea doesn't work so well even for the blacks, because look at where 10 years of driving the whites out has gotten them. All the things that we predicted, that we predicted on your show, that people said, right. Nah, it's never going to be like that, all those things happened. The whites left, the economy collapsed, farming collapsed, the blacks live off handouts from the UN, Mugabe still tortures people. Everything that we predicted happened that way. And it will be the same in South Africa. Already the BBC has said that 90% of the farms that have been given away in South Africa have been complete flops. So all those things that we've discussed, they will happen in South Africa, and they will happen in the way that we said that they will. The big question is of course, whether, you know, whites have two choices in South Africa, and whites are split. And as I've lived in these countries and I've observed these debates, you know, people look at the odds and then people say, well, you know, given this situation, can we make a successful stand? Can we fight and succeed? Should we rather go over and just become political animals? And should we try and, for example, try and create political parties and get blacks to vote for us? And the route that South Africa has taken is the English-speaking white opted for the option of trying to teach the blacks liberalism. And they have gone all the way to trying to win the black vote.
Right.
And you get people like Helen Ziller. She's a Jewish South African. She opposed apartheid. She protested against apartheid. In her day, we would have regarded her as a communist, really. But anyway, this woman now runs the opposition in parliament, and she's trying to turn the blacks into liberals. Now, let me tell you a secret, Jeff. I know people inside the Democratic Alliance, which she is mm-hmm. a part of. Mm-hmm. I've asked them about how many blacks actually did vote for them. Mm-hmm. Do you want to know the joke? The people who vote the most for the liberal English-speaking opposition are actually Afrikaners and English-speaking whites.
Wow.
The blacks hardly vote for them at all.
Right.
The blacks don't care. The blacks aren't interested in their politics. So as far as I'm concerned, the liberals have gone as far as they're going to go in South Africa. Then you get the Afrikaner, and these Afrikaners are fighting for their Afrikaner identity. And they are saying that we've lived in Africa for 350 years. We've lived longer in Africa than whites have been in Australia. We've lived longer in Africa than whites have been in New Zealand or Canada. We've lived in Africa for as long as whites have lived in America. So we are a valid tribe. We've got our own language. We had our own territory. By all the definitions of the European Union, Afrikaners are a nation. And there are those who say that, you know, we should strive for our own thing.
Mm-hmm. That's a logical and pragmatic position.
And Tib Lodge is a particular guy that I need to just mention.
All right. Okay, back in just a minute with Jan. I also said, realizing that the chances for the Afrikaners to acquire their own piece of real estate in South Africa were very small, and that if it came to the point where they were facing extermination, that the United States must take them in as political refugees and open the doors. We've allowed 35 million illegal aliens in here. Why not 2 or 3 million white Afrikaners from South Africa? Common sense again. Good luck. Be right back. Okay, let's get right back to our conversation. All right, Jan, we have about 8 minutes left, so please go right ahead.
Okay. Well, the murder of Eugene Tiblanche the other day, I mean, he's right-wing, he's portrayed as a Nazi and all that, but I'll tell you why Afrikaners remember him and why they're going to remember him longer than they're going to remember F.W. de Klerk. I know many people, and I know many common Afrikaners, and they have quite a soft spot for this guy. This guy is portrayed as a Nazi and all that sort of thing, and he was involved in racist incidents. Some are important, some are small and minor, and so forth, and blown out of all proportion by the media. But the reality is that Eugene Tablanche really just tried to explain to people that he's an Afrikaner, he thinks he has a right to be here, and he's going to try and fight for it. He originally stood up, he belonged to a little known party called the HNP, the Herstichter Nationale Partei. And the HNP was run by a guy called Jaap Maree. Jaap Maree often turned around. He was the Afrikaner who is the most knowledgeable about Rhodesia. And he constantly said, the guys who are coming to take over South Africa are communists, and we must fight these guys. And Eugene Tablanche was a member of that party. He unsuccessfully stood for parliament through them. But Eugene Tablanche's message was the same. One thing they don't mention in any of the biographies here about Eugene Tablanche is that Tablanche at one point was in the bodyguard protecting leaders of this country. And at another point, because he was a policeman, and this guy at a point was actually sent to Rhodesia, and he actually fought. He spent a little bit of time in Rhodesia fighting the Mugabes in that time. And he came back to South Africa and he kept telling Afrikaners, the guys who are coming to take over your country are communists. These guys are going to turn this country into a communist state, and there's going to be no place for us. And Afrikaners these days look back on de Klerk. What did de Klerk do? He handed over the power to the ANC. Then his entire political party collapsed. And he ran away, and he went out of politics, and he left the whites with nobody. Tablanche, on the other hand, at least always stood up. He wasn't eloquent. He was kind of stupid in certain things he did, but he at least had the courage to stand up. And that is why people remember this guy. And to me, the most important thing Tablanche ever said, he said a lot of stuff, and he was a great orator and so forth in Afrikaans. But to me, the most important thing he ever said was he said a simple thing. He said, an Afrikaner just wants to be an Afrikaner. I just want to be myself. He basically was saying, I just want to be myself. Leave me alone to believe what I want to believe, to live how I want to live. Just let me be. That's all the guy wanted. And they will try and weave all sorts of complex things about this guy here and that guy there. All he tried to do was he tried to make a couple of stands. And rather than other people who just sat back on their couches and did nothing, this guy tried to do something. He wasn't a brilliant mind. He wasn't a great soldier. He was a flop in many things he did. But he tried. And that is why Afrikaners are never going to forget this guy. Because he made a stand for them. And I'll tell you something. At one point, that guy controlled the biggest private army in South Africa. At one point, he had 70,000 members under his command. They didn't achieve all that much. But do you know, 2 years ago, the AWB, which he'd created, started reviving. And even now that he's died, I've had women tell me, you know what, I'm going to go join the AWB. Why do the whites go and join this weird right-wing organization? They do it because they feel threatened, and it was the only organization that ever attempted to fight for them. And that is the legacy of these people, Jeff. That is why his murder is such an important thing. And he might not have been a great intellectual, and there are lots of intellectuals, but where are the intellectuals? They're right. All hiding, Jeff.
Yep.
They're all hiding away.
Yep. Most
this
of
was
them are...
the one guy who stood up.
Okay, welcome back. Hour number three, going to South Africa this hour to talk to our longtime friend and colleague, Jan Lamprecht, and a special guest as well. Let's go down and see how everything is early morning down there. Are you there, Jan?
Yeah, how are you?
Good, good. Still here, thank you. And you?
Yeah, I'm alive, yeah.
Yeah, well, I just remember back when we first began doing our radio visits long ago and how different things were, even though we knew where South Africa and where South Africa's whites and Afrikaners, of course, were headed. It didn't make it any easier to take when it happens, and it's happening very fast. We've got 40 plus million blacks, about 4 million whites, and it is beyond racist down there, beyond. The only country that's potentially more racist is probably Israel. But the problem with South Africa is the whites could be targeted for a genocidal extermination campaign very easily and very quickly. So something needs to be done soon. These people's lives are unequivocally in danger. Their lot in life is only deteriorating and only going to get worse. We've seen the model in Zimbabwe, and we are seeing it now begin to be implemented in South Africa. Give us your view, Jan, and then we'll say hello to our special guest in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, Jeff. Little by little, things are carrying on. And the thing that is really concerning is this Julius Malema character who heads the ANC Youth League. You know, to put it in perspective, in South Africa, we have a massive population of young people. You know, the birth rate is so high, and we have huge numbers of young people. I think they say that something like a quarter of South Africa's population is under 25. And these blacks, they're getting a very bad education, if any at all.
If any, right.
Job opportunities are worse than ever in the country's history.
Right.
So there are these vast numbers of badly educated, unemployed and unemployable blacks. And the main reason they're there is actually due to the policies of the government. And the government itself, you know, now allows and sees the future as being tapping into this sort of lunatic fringe that's out there of the youth. And they're allowing the ANC Youth League to walk around talking like Mugabe. And, I mean, this guy, Malema, had a march the other day where he marched something like 3,000 people to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange.
Probably not many whites in the crowd, were there?
No whites in the crowd.
Just kidding.
And he marched them to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange with various demands. He tells the blacks openly that the enemy are the white people. The middle-aged white men are their enemy. He also marched them up to the union buildings, which is where our government is located. And, you know, this guy is the guy who walked around last year saying, shoot the Boer, and he's talking land invasions. This guy is talking the utmost racism. And you know what? The government even backs him and claims that this isn't racism, even though everybody can see it's racism. To me, the things that Malema is doing out in the open, the light slaps that he gets on his wrist, Jeff, this is just not good news.
Well,
need in this country,
yes,
is this kind of racial hatred being stirred up.
He's being empowered, obviously, by the powers that be, the controllers there. This man is not out flapping his gums for no reason.
Absolutely, Jeff. You know something? There was another ANC youth leader a couple of years ago under President Mbeki. And he also came out at the time and he said a couple of things. President Mbeki shut him up in 2 seconds. Why our current president claims that he cannot shut up Malema is a load of nonsense. He cannot tell me that the president of the country can't shut up any member of his party if he wants to.
I couldn't agree more.
Oh, yeah.
This brings us to, I guess, the time to introduce, if you will do the honors, our special guest tonight. And tell us who he is and why he is with us tonight.
Okay. The man I'm going to introduce you to is a guy called Christo Burger. He's an Afrikaner who left this country about 17 years ago. He saw what was coming. He left, moved to the USA, and did very well in the USA. He is now an American citizen, absolutely loves America, but he's never forgotten his roots, and he knows what lies in store for the people here. And he comes and visits South Africa as often as he can, and he tries to do what he can for Afrikaners. And what he's done is he's launched a website called United for Victory, unitedforvictory.org. And this website is dedicated to the coming Afrikaner genocide and to his plan for trying to assist people in the event that things go really sour here.
All right, very good. Christo, are you on the line?
Yes, Jeff. Very nice meeting you and your audience, and I'm so glad to talk to you, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, it's my pleasure. As you know, I've been working with Jan for years to try to bring the plight of South African Afrikaners and whites in general to the world. And where we are now, as I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, is that we are literally on the doorstep of a Zimbabwe-esque, but maybe even worse, genocide. We've watched the slaughter of South African white farm families, the torture, murders of so many innocents over the years. The pictures are horrific. This is not changing. What we're doing here as a nation, at least in terms of its potential, is nothing. I just don't see anything the United States is doing. It's not being talked about. What we need to do is somehow introduce legislation here, in my opinion, in the Congress, to build a bridge for political refugees from South Africa. These people are facing extermination. I think they need to be brought here and given every opportunity that the illegal aliens get, and then some. I mean, this is outrageous. We've got 35 million illegal aliens in this country who are not in any threat at all of being exterminated, and yet we have 4 million plus whites in South Africa, most of whom are certainly under the crosshairs for targeting for extinction. Tell us how you see it, Christo, and if I'm wrong, please correct me.
Jeff, no, I couldn't agree more, but here is the perspective that I'm taking it from. Genocide International has upgraded South Africa now to a phase 6 out of a possible 8. It means that there is already a low-intensity genocide going on. Now, as we know, America played a very important role in putting this corrupt and evil government in place.
They sure did, yeah.
This is now the issue, and I am an extremely proud American. I love my new country beyond that any person can believe. And we are so privileged to see how wonderful and free our country is. But that just makes it much more painful to see what is happening to my people. So what I have done, Jeff, is I have studied the issues of what is a genocide so that the people can understand it and how it is defined by the international body, the Genocide Watch of Dr. Stanton. And here is what I am proposing at the moment. We need to first take action that I believe is extremely important. And my plan is to bring a petition in front of the United Nations. What I want to do is to bring this urgent application under the Convention of the Prevention of a Genocide. After the genocide in Rwanda, the previous Secretary General, Kofi Annan, put an action plan in place, and that is what we call a convention, to prevent genocides. The problem is that normally the things work in this way, that a genocide happens and then the investigations come, but you cannot, you know, once you it has happened, you cannot reverse it. You cannot bring 800,000 or a million people back to life. You can hunt down the bad guys. Now, the issue that I am pushing and ask for your listeners to support me is that here we have got an opportunity to go to the United Nations and ask General Secretary Ban Ki-moon to put this action plan that Kofi Annan wrote and send a full United Nations genocide prevention force to South Africa. And this is a matter of very urgent and extreme urgency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a precautionary and proactive act, what I want to do is to go ahead and register the South Africans on a basis that, you know, they can just choose to join, to be classified as a refugee. That gives them very special rights. There are 26 contracting countries throughout the world who has contracted to accept a refugee. And this is the plan, is then once we get ourselves classified, is first to prevent it here in South Africa.
Yes.
And then also issue the people who wish so with an international refugee travel document.
Very good. Stand by, Christo, just a moment or two. We have to pause for a couple of minutes of business. We'll be right back. And Christo talking about the plight of South Africa's Afrikaner and white population. All right, Christo, go ahead. So the idea of getting people certified with international refugee status cards, these are issued by the United Nations?
Well, I am busy, you know, there is a pro forma on the convention on the status of the refugee in to which this travel document should, you know,
yes.
Be specified to. So I'm busy doing that. Naturally, the application will be once we show substantial support for this. I'm hoping to get at least 500,000 people together, and then once with 500,000 people claiming refugee status, and then go to the United Nations and ask that this travel document then will become an official document. With this also will have to come an evacuation plan and a plan to prevent, you know, the slaughter of the people.
I have, Christo, for years offered my services in this capacity of a journalist on the site and on the radio program to do anything I can to form some kind of a bridge for these people to come over here. South Africans are highly creative and productive people. There's no question about that. Do they have a future in South Africa? Not in my opinion. And I'm not a South African, so I can only speak from my position over here. I just don't see it happening.
Jeff, let me just take this opportunity to thank you as a fellow American for what you're doing for our people. This is just heartwarming to see that you have got the ability and the vision to see what is happening. And I cannot express more gratitude on behalf of these people that goes through excruciating pain. You know, we have now got 800,000 white squatters who has been pushed out of the economy for only one reason, the fact that they are human beings with a white skin on.
800,000 homeless squatters.
And these were productive people. You go there, you see engineers, you see technical people, you see farmers.
Right.
These people live outside today. They've lost everything. They the fact that they have got a white skin on means that they cannot have a job. And this is painful. I am, you know, I've got a camera team here that, you know, is busy documenting all this as evidence, because we need, you know, to bring evidence to what is going on. But the government has always been hiding around, behind this, you know, great constitution. But if you analyze what is going on in this country now, the government is breaking their own constitution, and I'm now claiming that this government has nullified itself. It's not a government anymore. You cannot break your own constitution and become criminal under the constitution, then use the legislative and judicial system to protect your criminal acts. It is not a government anymore. You know, this is how bad the situation is.
I understand. I'm just grief-stricken to hear that nearly a million whites, because of the color of their skin, are essentially homeless and squatters. This is wrong. We have over 30 million easily illegal refugees in these formerly United States. Most of them are of Latino heritage. They are not engineers. They are not doctors. They are the lower elements of Mexico, Central America, some South America. There are actually people from over 72 different countries here as illegals. We need to bring these people over here as legal immigrants, genocidal refugees. We've got to get them out of there. We've got to put them to work, give them an opportunity. I know the South African ethic enough that if you were to give these people a piece of raw land, I don't care where it is, as long as they had water, potable water, good clean water for agrarian and other uses, they would survive and create a most prosperous asset to this country. I have no question about it. None.
Thank you, Jeff. Once again, you know, I see how we have built up a first world country here in Africa. In some aspects, you can just build things so beautiful, so effective, and so prosperous, and these people can certainly do it again. They just need an opportunity, and I'm fighting for that. And you know what we are facing with here is a deep human issue, that if this genocide happens, and every person who are aware of this, that genocide happens on your clock. And I want to challenge Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, to come to South Africa. She was one of the leaders to put this evil government in place.
Yeah, Mad Max.
Come and face the music here. Mm-hmm. She and, you know, all the black leaders who fought for this great democracy, and come and see what big mess it is. That then come and experience the blood and the pain that is here now. This is the fruit that they have produced. And now they are silent. Now they don't show up. Now they just, you know... This is what I want them to come and face. Show up. Come and look at the rewards of what you have created here. Well, don't just stay behind. Excuse me, sir.
No, you're right. It's an accurate and correct assessment and a reasonable call. But these people have no shame, Christo, none. They are shameless criminals. They are professional political whores. They are less than worthless. Stand by, gentlemen. We'll come right back and continue our conversation. A current look at the deplorable and disintegrating condition for whites in what was once a remarkable advanced first world country, South Africa. Lamprecht in South Africa and Christo here in the States. Jan, we've covered some ground here. You're there watching it. 800,000, it's hard to believe. Was this 20? How many years ago was it when South Africa was booming and prosperous and a true first world country? How long ago?
Yeah, Jeff. I mean, South Africa really developed at a hell of a pace. In fact, the building up of South Africa really started during the Great Depression, can you believe? It actually started when the Afrikaners started gaining more power and control in this country. And a lot of the greatest institutions that were built up in this country that became the backbone of the infrastructure and the scientific and business development actually were formed in the 1930s. And, you know, by the time a guy like Verwoerd came to power, he built most of the modern infrastructure that exists in South Africa today was built in the 1960s. And, you know, in just a It took the Afrikaners just a couple of decades to take this country and turn it into the most advanced country in Africa. It was the only country in Africa that actually was classified as a first world country. And by the way, that status was lost under the current government. Your country, for example, when we want to travel to your country, we are no longer treated as first world people. Your country's got special rules. If people want to come there and they are third world, then we have to produce all kinds of all kinds of documentation to show that we have jobs, to show that we have income and property and stuff here,
right,
so that we don't come over and squat in your country. So, you know, we've been classified as a third world country for almost the last 10 years now. So it's only after these changes that we've gone downhill. And, you know, the extent to which we've gone downhill is hideous. I was, and Jeff, it's not just the whites that have gone backwards, it's the blacks too. The extent to which the blacks have collapsed themselves, you know, black education is ridiculous compared to what it was under apartheid. They won't go around talking too much about this because it's actually one of the big things that they promised that they never delivered on. But I was reading recently that they were saying that in a survey of millions of young black young school children, that the average literacy in grade 3 is something like 35%. The average math scores are 30%. And so what you've got is the ANC is also in order to hide its failures, it has also reduced the pass rate. So you can get something like 40% or 30% and still be regarded as having got an official education, even though that education is meaningless. And now those millions upon millions of blacks who've got no future thanks to the ANC, now they want to take those same people and try and turn them into like a revolutionary army, because that's basically what Malema's talking about. And the game is now go after the whites. You know, you can't earn anything.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So let's go steal their land, drive them out. That's the way that we're going to go forward. And that's really what's coming. And let me tell you, Jeff, there are lots of things that are happening in this country that this government hides. For example, there have been land invasions that have been taking place in the last 10 years, but you see almost nothing about it in the media. The international media doesn't say a word about it.
Right.
I was reading that recently some blacks went and invaded some church land, and they went and stole 57 hectares of land, claimed it as their own, and the church then had to try and get an eviction order. Then a bunch of blacks went recently, they invaded the land of an Afrikaner, and when they invaded his land, they then claimed that it belonged to Julius Malema. So, you know, these little things don't make headlines. They're just hidden away in the odd small news article here and there. But, I mean, this is land invasion, Zimbabwe style. This is totally illegal. Why are these people not being thrown out? And another thing that's also happening is black discontent is on the rise, and blacks are rioting across this country. I was reading also that blacks were petrol bombing a police vehicle. But again, that kind of stuff you don't hear anything about. It's all hidden away, you know. All is good. Crime is on the decline.
Sure.
And so forth. That's been the official party line for the last 10 years.
And the actual...
So that's not the reality.
How does the actual city infrastructure look in most major cities? It has to be beginning to show signs of degradation and disintegration.
Yes, Jeff. There's no question about it. You know, we go through phases where for quite a while we have quite a lot of problems. You know, the one thing, I'll give you a very simple thing. When I went to your country, I was so amazed when I was just driving on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I thought to myself, my goodness, but you know, the paint is so bright. And it was only when I came back to South Africa that I realized, you know, that they hadn't painted lines on our roads in like 10 years. And you know, you get used to not seeing lines anymore, and you start getting used to potholes appearing in roads. And the other thing that annoys me a lot, and that's the cause of a lot of problems, is traffic lights. The thing as simple as traffic lights, there are periods of time when we drive through the city, when in a short 10-kilometer drive, you will come across several traffic lights no longer working or partly working. That's the worst of the lot, where some of the lights work and others don't, and then you could have accidents happening. And it goes on like that for weeks. And you have to go and complain and moan. I actually use my website as a platform, and I go and I say, well, this traffic light's not working, that one's not working.
Really?
And then eventually I see after a week or two, somebody's actually probably bothered actually going to do their work. But until I put it on my website, absolutely nothing happens for weeks and weeks on end.
Well,
stuff goes on all the time.
We've talked many times. We're going to take a break and then come right back and continue to speak with Christo. We've talked about the lack of focus, the lack of drive, the lack of a work ethic that is now beginning to boil up and overcome the entire country. There seems to be no centralized vision, no idea of coordination, nothing like that. It's all just falling into the sewers.
You know, Jeff, politics and political power is the number one issue. The government is more concerned with retaining political power than anything else.
Uh-huh.
And it will do anything. And I've had this argument. I've got a liberal friend here who's annoyed the hell out of me. And I say to him that, you know what, can't you see that it is in the benefit of the government. The government knows very well that it can't deliver on its promises. So its next step to remaining in power, because in the last election it lost quite a lot of support. It was very shocked by it. It's losing support among the blacks. And the next step is to turn to black racism and to then unite all the blacks against a fake common enemy, an enemy that doesn't exist, the enemy being the white. And because we're a minority, they can overwhelm us and kick us around. And
songs advocating the genocide of the South African people are not only being sung, they're being acted out in the blood and genocide of thousands of white South Africans. Here's a quote directly from the BBC. There have been more than 3,000 murders of Afrikaner farmers. It goes on, Afrikaner farmers have objected to ANC Youth League chief Julius Malema singing Kill the Boer. They say the constant refrain of the song incites people to kill white farmers. The ANC and Julius Malema have defended the song. A detailed study of these crimes by Nedbank revealed that, quote, robbery was not the prime motivation. In fact, in 85% of last year's farm attacks, nothing had been stolen. The murder rate for white farmers is the highest of any group in the entire world, and it's not just farmers who are victims. An estimated 35,000 non-farm whites have been murdered on the roads and in their homes and businesses across South Africa. But perhaps the most shocking thing is that many of you watching this know nothing about it, but that changes right now. Hello, this is David Duke. What I present here will challenge everything you've heard and think you know about South Africa. Even for those of you awake to the lies of the media, the ongoing genocide of white people in South Africa will deeply shock you. For those whose eyes are not yet open, I pray that the facts of this genocide will somehow touch your heart. You will find out if you truly respect and honor human rights and human life, or whether you're so racist that you disregard human rights when Europeans are victims. There is a horrific, purposeful genocide going on right at this moment against white South Africans. Here's a short news clip of Dr. Gregory Stanton, the head of Genocide Watch.
Dr. Gregory H. Stanton is a retired American professor of law who heads Genocide Watch, the organization that coordinates the international campaign to end genocide.
It seems to me a very troubling statistic that the murder rate of the farmers, Boer farmers, is about four times as high as it is for the rest of the population. There is a motive of hatred, that these are hate crimes, that people are tortured, that they're murdered in ways that are dehumanizing.
Not only does Stanton believe farm murders are hate crimes, but he has also recently warned the world that the white farmers in South Africa could be facing genocide.
Now, these are not just numbers on paper. These are real people with real families with human feelings.
A mother's hand on her daughter's coffin. And a teenage boy crying out for his mother. Overwhelmed by emotion, a family member faints at the graveside. In just 7 days, South African farming communities have buried yet another three victims of murder. Elsie Swart was killed shortly after her 50th birthday. I feel bitter. She was severely tortured, say her parents. Burned with an electric iron, beaten, and then strangled to death. The cops here have long lost count of the murders they have attended on farms in this province. What awaits them on a call-out is usually a scene of indescribable brutality. Like so many other victims, this elderly couple arrived back home from church on a Sunday morning. In a macabre display, the killers left their Bibles displayed on the bodies. In an outside room, a third member of the family was tied up with wire, then tortured and killed. Scenes like these are difficult to forget, and to deal with the trauma, even the most hardened policemen often need psychiatric counseling. An old man's hand resting on the arm of his wife of many years. She raped, police say, probably while he was forced to watch. Finally, with their throats slit, they died next to each other.
Here are calls for white murder along with worship of their genocidal inspiration, Joe Slovo. Who is Joe Slovo? Interestingly, both Joe Slovo and Menachem Begin lived in the same region of Eastern Europe where Jews were imbued with deep fear and hatred of Christian Europeans. One ended up in Israel terrorizing Christians and Muslim Palestinians. The other ended up in South Africa terrorizing European Christians there. Here he is with his followers Winnie and Nelson Mandela beneath a symbol of communism. Few people in the West even know that Mandela supported terrorist bombings of innocent men, women, and children. Here is the Mandela they don't let you see in the controlled media. Here's the media version of Mandela that they show you.
Mr. Mandela, can you tell us how you feel visiting this spot at this time?
It is a very emotional moment for us. For peace. For love among South Africans.
He sings Kill the White People in his language and then tells us in English how devoted he is to peace and love, and the media covers it up. And take a look at Mandela's wife, Winnie. Now, Winnie likes to burn people alive with tires and gasoline. She said, quote, "With our boxes of matches and our necklaces, we shall liberate this country." The truth is that white South Africans have nothing to be ashamed about. The Boers created a great nation, one so good for blacks that millions came for the jobs, education, medical care that the whites had created. Before the ANC takeover, only 5% were unemployed. Now it's over 50%. Before the ANC, it was once a safe country for both whites and blacks, and now it's the murder and rape capital of the world. Most African nations are dominated by the ethnic murder and repression of tribalism. They are rife with murder, corruption, dictatorship. The conditions for the black people in those nations are horrendous. They are far less free than they ever were in the old South Africa. Why was South Africa so demonized by the media? The very same year that apartheid fell, the Hutus in Rwanda killed 800,000 Tutsis in horrific genocide. Black ethnic genocides happened in the Congo, Somalia, Ethiopia, Chad, Zimbabwe, Angola, Liberia, Botswana, Mali, Mozambique. I could go on and on. But media coverage of Africa was nothing but a hate fest against the best, safest, and freest nation in all of Africa. In fact, of all the tribes in Africa, South Africa was led by the most benevolent tribe of all. Nowhere in Africa did blacks live better or more free than in South Africa. It is really quite insane. The media shows you old pictures of different ethnic bathrooms in white South Africa as proof of its evil. This while thousands of whites are now being tortured and murdered. I don't think there is any moral comparison between separate bathrooms and genocide. I tell you the real evil. It's the evil media that supported the overthrow of South Africa to a bunch of communist terrorists who even sing songs of genocide and murder. The true racists and haters now have South Africa in their clutches, and God help both the white South Africans and the black South Africans who are now on a highway to hell. South Africa is heading toward the same corrupt and murderous tribalism and genocide as the rest of Africa. If you really care anything about human rights, raise your voice against this genocide of South African white people. The world must demand an end to this ongoing genocide. This is a test for all you folks out there who say you really believe in human rights. If you don't believe in human rights for white people too, then you don't believe in human rights at all. Together, we must save these victims of ongoing genocide before it is too late.
One of the bullets came straight through the back window where Emily was sitting. And just in a single moment, your whole life changes. Look at their future in this country and say, could have been my child. Do we sit and wait until it's too late?
Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. The Lesson of Africa.
Hello. Another white farmer in South Africa was murdered a few days ago. He was 65-year-old Daniel Marais. His wife Maria managed to escape from their farm near Bloemfontein and run 3 miles with their grandchild to a neighboring farm after she had been assaulted by a black. Maurice himself, however, was too badly wounded by the black attacker to escape, and he died on his farm. 2 weeks ago, blacks invaded the Van Niekerk farm near Witbank. They beat 71-year-old Gerhardus Van Niekerk on the face and head with a metal rod until they thought he was dead, then shot him in the face. Although Van Niekerk lost a lot of blood, he survived the attack. He was one of the lucky few. Most don't survive. A few days before the Van Niekerk attack, a gang of blacks descended on the farm of 65-year-old Don Delafield and his 52-year-old wife, Verena, 80 miles from Johannesburg. The white farmer and his wife were tied up, tortured savagely, and then butchered by the blacks. A note left at the scene identified the murderers as members of the Azanian People's Liberation Army, the military wing of the Pan-Africanist Congress. 20 white farmers and members of their families have been murdered in South Africa in the past 6 weeks. That's about the same rate at which white farmers and their families were murdered by blacks in South Africa during 1997. If that were happening to white families in the United States at a proportional rate, it would be 100 families a week being murdered, a major problem indeed. White farmers in South Africa, of course, are very alarmed about the murders, and they've sent several delegations to Nelson Mandela and other government officials to demand that something be done. They're not getting much satisfaction from the government, however. The government says that its hands already are full trying to deal with the crime situation in South Africa, and that it can't spare any additional policemen to investigate the attacks on white farms. Robbery, rape, and murder have soared since the whites of South Africa voted to turn their country over to black rule 4 years ago. White farmers are convinced that the attacks on them are more than a simple matter of crime. If the blacks attacking their farms merely had robbery in mind, it would not be necessary to torture and kill their white victims. The whites believe that the aim of the black gangs is terrorism, and the note left at the scene of the Delafield murders supports their belief. The white farmers also note that the farmers who had been murdered were in many cases those who had been well known for their generosity to their black workers. They suspect that the aim of the murderers is to drive the white farmers out of South Africa, and so the terrorists are striking preferentially at the whites who have good relations with blacks. Mandela's government doesn't want the white farmers driven out because it would be an economic catastrophe for South Africa. The white farmers produce nearly all of South Africa's food and much of its foreign exchange. But many blacks are more concerned with grabbing white wealth now than they are with the long-term prosperity of the country. In addition, the idea of forcing the whites out appeals to many blacks at an emotional level. Being dependent on the productivity of white farmers is galling to blacks, and they are more inclined to kill the goose now than to continue collecting the golden eggs. If the murder of white farm families continues at the rate of the past 18 months, the terrorists undoubtedly will succeed. And there is little chance that the Mandela government or any black successor government will be able to stop the killings. The government of South Africa becomes more chaotic and inefficient by the month. And if it can do nothing to control soaring crime in Johannesburg, it is unlikely to have much influence on terrorism in the countryside. The really disappointing aspect to all of this is that it should have been foreseen. The whites of South Africa voted themselves into their present situation when they agreed to let blacks participate in their elections in 1994. They folded up under the pressure of being called bad names by the Jewish media and being told by their preachers that Jesus was angry at them because of apartheid. They were so eager to be in the good graces of Jesus, the Jews, and the international community that they took leave of their senses and handed their government over to Nelson Mandela and his fellow black terrorists on a silver platter. And they believed the assurances of the media and their bought politicians that everything would work out for the best if they let the blacks run South Africa. That's really incredible, considering what they knew about black behavior in the rest of Africa. Consider Kolwezi, for example. Now, white listeners in North America won't have heard of Kolwezi, of course, because the Jewish media kept pretty quiet about it over here. It's the sort of thing the Jews thought it better for us not to hear about. And so, after a few sketchy news reports, they blacked it out and never mentioned it again. But they couldn't keep it from the South Africans, who were much more attuned to what was happening in Africa than we were. Anyway, Kolwezi was a mining town in the Shaba province of what was known 20 years ago as Zaire. Before that, it was known as the Belgian Congo. And today, under the rule of its latest African strongman, it is known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Belgians had turned their colony over to black rule in 1960 as part of the general decolonization process which accompanied the egalitarian craze following the Second World War. A deranged black Marxist ideologue, Patrice Lumumba, presided over the transition to black rule of the Congo, and the killing and rape of whites began almost immediately. Most of the whites in the Congo weren't natives as in South Africa. They were Belgian administrators and technicians and mining engineers, along with a few Christian missionaries and doctors and nurses. But many of the longer-term white residents had their families with them. In 1964, when one of the black factions struggling for control of the Congo captured Stanleyville, an administrative center with a population of about 25,000 where more than 2,000 whites were living, the rapes and murders of whites flared up again. Belgian paratroopers had to capture Stanleyville in order to rescue the terrified white survivors. Most Americans heard briefly about that at the time, but the news certainly wasn't emphasized, and so we quickly forgot about it. The South Africans didn't forget, though. Then in May 1978, while the Congo was temporarily going by the name of Zaire, a black tribal faction that was at odds with the central government moved into Kolwezi. Kolwezi, a town of about 20,000 inhabitants at the time in the southeastern part of the country, was a local center for the copper and cobalt mining in the area, and a number of white engineers and technicians were there, some with their wives and children. The blacks, who were opposed to the central government, saw the white minority in Kolwezi as supporters of the central government because it was the whites who were keeping the mines running. The whites, of course, were on neither side of the conflict. They were there simply to do a job, and they didn't concern themselves much with black politics. But the fact that their activity in operating the mines was keeping the central government afloat was all the excuse the black rebels needed to kill them. And of course, the blacks went about killing the whites in a typically black fashion, with lots of gang raping and mutilation. White women had their breasts hacked off with machetes. Little white girls were literally raped to death by long lines of grinning blacks while their parents were forced at gunpoint to watch. Little white boys had their bellies slit open and their entrails pulled out. Altogether, 160 whites were butchered in Kolwezi. Even though that was in 1978, it made enough of an impression on white South Africans that they shouldn't have forgotten it by 1994. And if Stanleyville and Kolwezi weren't enough, There were plenty of other instructive examples for the white South Africans. There was what happened in Angola in 1961 when Portuguese colonists were butchered in a terror campaign so awful that I cannot describe the details on this program. It is perhaps more difficult to sympathize with the Portuguese than with the Belgians, because many of the Portuguese had, as we say, gone native. They didn't keep themselves separate enough from the blacks around them. Some had even taken black wives and had mulatto children. Race mixing wasn't as abhorrent to the Portuguese as to other Europeans in Africa. Nevertheless, what the blacks did to the Portuguese, even those with non-white family members, was as bloody and cruel as anything done to other Europeans in Africa. The whites of Rhodesia, South Africa's neighbor, certainly didn't mix with the blacks in their country. The whites of Rhodesia not only maintained their dignity and pride as Europeans, but they did a very creditable job of keeping their blacks under control. Even the Rhodesian farmers, whose farms often were isolated and many miles from their nearest neighbors, were quite successful at dealing with black terrorists. In Rhodesia, the blacks struck at the easiest white targets, and these were the Christian missionary stations. Various Christian churches had set up missionary stations throughout Rhodesia for the purpose of converting the blacks to Christianity. And these stations usually had schools and clinics associated with them. Furthermore, they were unarmed. When black terrorists would descend on one of these missionary stations, they would rape and butcher all of the whites they could get their hands on. This happened over and over again, and the South Africans heard all of the grisly details every time. Nevertheless, the white South African government betrayed the white Rhodesians in 1976 by joining the United Nations embargo against Rhodesia and cutting off Rhodesia's supply of helicopters and other weapons. This move forced the Rhodesians to capitulate to the blacks, and their country, now called Zimbabwe, is ruled by one of the former black terrorist leaders, who is now a de facto president for life, and has announced a plan to seize the land of the white farmers who remain in the country. The South Africans betrayed the Rhodesians in 1976 in part because the Jews of South Africa always have had a strong influence on the South African government through their media control and their money. Harry Oppenheimer, with his vast holdings in diamonds, gold, and other minerals, had more money with which to corrupt politicians than anyone else in South Africa. And the Jews, of course, were as implacably hostile to the whites of Rhodesia as they have been to other whites everywhere and at all times. And in part, the white South Africans betrayed the Rhodesians because they thought that by throwing their white neighbors to the wolves, they could buy time for themselves. As it turned out, it wasn't much time, just 18 years. During those 18 years, they really should have been paying more attention to what was happening in other parts of Africa. The fact that they learned nothing from the examples of Angola and Stanleyville and Kolwezi and the Christian missions in Rhodesia should be instructive to us. I talked with several South Africans before 1994. None were in favor of surrendering their country to the blacks, but they had some very strange notions about what black rule would mean. They thought that because the blacks of South Africa had a standard of living so much higher than blacks anywhere else in Africa, they wouldn't do anything to jeopardize that. Blacks might engage in terrorism in Angola and Zaire. Those are very primitive countries, and the blacks there are savages. But the blacks in South Africa are better educated and better treated than elsewhere. Blacks, these white South Africans told me, are like children. They can't run a modern country like South Africa by themselves. They need the whites to keep things going for them, and the whites will be able to control them just as they have for the past 400 years. These white South Africans that I spoke with were very civilized, very comfortable people. They all had black servants back home. I think that they just couldn't deal with the idea of a South Africa without blacks, a South Africa in which whites would take care of their own children, clean their own toilets, cook their own meals, cut their own grass, take out their own garbage, and take in their belts enough to cope with any economic pressure applied to them by the rest of the world. It's too bad they weren't a little less civilized and a little less comfortable. Perhaps they'd still have their own country today. Perhaps they wouldn't be reading in their newspapers every week about three or four more white farm families butchered by black terrorists. Perhaps they wouldn't have to be thinking now about where they'll immigrate to. And perhaps I shouldn't be so hard on them. Certainly, they did an enormously foolish and shameful thing in giving up their country without a fight. But are we Americans any less foolish? Think how many white Americans there are who believe that we'll all continue to live together as happy consumers and television viewers, regardless of race, color, or creed, when America has a non-white majority around the middle of the next century. Our blacks, they believe, are much more civilized than those blacks who are butchering white farm families in South Africa. Or rather, that's what they had believed if the Jew-controlled news media in America had told them about what's happening now in South Africa, wouldn't they? I mean, white Americans certainly have never given any evidence of being more intelligent, more independent-minded, more courageous, or more morally upright than South Africans. So why should we expect Americans to make better use than the South Africans did of the knowledge of what to expect under non-white rule if the Jewish media let them have that knowledge? Of course, three white farmers a week or 100 a week being murdered by black terrorists in South Africa isn't really news that our people need, is it? At least, it's not news that fits. Much better to restrict the news from Africa to scenes of Mr. Clinton hugging happy blacks. I said that perhaps we can learn from the example of the South Africans. Of course, when I say we, I don't mean white Americans as a whole. Since white South Africans as a whole didn't learn a thing from the example of the Portuguese and the Belgians and the Rhodesians, I don't expect Americans to do any better. But perhaps some of us can learn a few things. One of those things is that we really need to find a better way than mass democracy for governing ourselves. We've been fed a lot of egalitarian baloney about people all being pretty much the same. And so we tend to assume that since we can look at facts and make rational decisions, everyone else can. But most people cannot. Most people are not rational and can be manipulated by playing on their fears and desires the way the majority of South African whites were manipulated by the media and the churches in their country in 1994. The South Africans didn't want the sort of situation they have today, but they let themselves be bullied and lied and tricked into it. If only hard-headed and rational South African whites had been permitted to vote in 1994, South Africa still would be a white-ruled country today, perhaps even an all-white country. The second thing we should learn from the South African experience is that we cannot permit our mass media to remain in the hands of the Jews or in the hands of those under the influence of Jews. The foolish South Africans were manipulated, and it was the mass media more than anything else which manipulated them. The Jewish media in South Africa could not keep the news of black behavior in other parts of Africa away from white South Africans, but they could and did play down that news, and they could and did berate South Africans nonstop about the wickedness of apartheid and about how awful it was to be unpopular among liberals in other countries. And they could and did play on the feminine nature of the white masses by telling them over and over, as seductively as possible, how nice it would be to be loved by the international community instead of being hated. And the third thing we must learn from the experience of whites in Africa is that the only way for our people to survive and flourish is to live among our own kind. Multiracial societies do not work and cannot work. If we permit whites to become a minority in America in the next century, as the Clintonistas are planning, then we will suffer a fate similar to that of whites everywhere else, that they have let themselves become a minority. What we must do to avoid becoming a minority may be extraordinarily hard, but we must do it to survive. The extinction of our people is the alternative. Thanks for being with me again today.
Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. The Lesson of Africa.
Hello. Another white farmer in South Africa was murdered a few days ago. He was 65-year-old Daniel Marais. His wife Maria managed to escape from their farm near Bloemfontein and run 3 miles with their grandchild to a neighboring farm after she had been assaulted by a black. Marais himself, however, was too badly wounded. Hello. Today let's talk about liberalism. Let's look at what this disease of the soul is doing to one group of our people. Let's look at the consequences of liberalism in a country in the southeastern part of the continent of Africa, a country which until 20 years ago was known as Rhodesia and today is called Zimbabwe. The reason Rhodesia is called Zimbabwe today is that in 1979, the Rhodesians, under intense diplomatic and economic pressure brought to bear against them by liberals in America and Europe, and to be completely honest about it, showing some symptoms of the disease themselves, decided to let blacks vote for the next government of Rhodesia. Since there were, at that time, 6 million blacks living in Rhodesia and only 275,000 white Rhodesians, this was, in effect, a decision by the Rhodesians to commit collective suicide. Some of them realized that fact at the time, but most didn't because, as I just mentioned, they were showing some early symptoms of liberalism. Today, most of the few Rhodesians who are left realize that they made a fatal mistake 21 years ago. But before we get to the Rhodesian situation today, let's just remember a little history. Early in the 19th century, people from the British Isles first began farming and mining operations in the part of Africa north of the Limpopo River and south of the Zambezi River, an area which later became Rhodesia. Murderous forays by blacks were a problem during the 19th century, even though they were more often intent on murdering and eating each other than on killing the white settlers. But eventually, the whites taught the blacks to behave themselves. By the beginning of the 20th century, the Rhodesian highlands were being farmed on a significant scale by white settlers. The Rhodesian highlands, with their almost European climate and fertile soil, weren't of much interest to the jungle-acclimated blacks, but the whites found the area ideal. and in the period between the two world wars, they built a thriving country, not only with farming and mining, but also with gleaming cities and a number of industries. After the Second World War, many veterans from England migrated to Rhodesia. The Rhodesian population was certainly a cut above that in Europe, taller, fairer, leaner, more enterprising and energetic on the average. Look at photographs taken in Salisbury, the capital, or on Rhodesian farms. The Rhodesian women especially were tall and blonde and beautiful. Rhodesia was a good place to live, a good place to raise white children. But, of course, there was a worm in the apple. A wave of liberalism was sweeping over Europe after the war. Liberalism had defeated fascism. The corpses of millions of liberalism's opponents were rotting in mass graves all over Europe after they had been machine-gunned, hanged, starved to death at the end of the war. Other millions of the opponents of liberalism were being worked to death in slave labor camps behind the Iron Curtain. Liberalism was triumphant, and even in happy, sunny Rhodesia, the malignant influence of liberalism made itself felt. The liberals in Europe were screaming about the evils of white colonialism and white imperialism. The white man was oppressing and exploiting the brown man in India and the black man in Africa, and it had to be stopped. After all, we were all equal. Race was an inconsequential detail, only a matter of skin color and nothing else. To think otherwise was to be a fascist, a racist. We had just won a horribly bloody war in order to exterminate the fascists and the racists. It was intolerable that we should permit racist policies to govern our colonies in Africa. The blacks must be given the vote. We must step down and hand everything over to our black equals. This insanity even had its proponents in Rhodesia, especially in the Christian churches there. Most Rhodesians at that time were in no mood for giving their country away, despite all of the liberal propaganda. After all, it was their country. They and their ancestors had built it. Despite the influx of immigrants still arriving from England, most Rhodesians had been born in Rhodesia and had lived there all their lives, and they knew what the blacks were like. They knew that the differences between whites and blacks involved infinitely more than skin color. Furthermore, they knew that they were not oppressing the blacks, who actually were much better off since the arrival of whites. The blacks greatly preferred an occasional lashing by a white farmer when they didn't work hard enough to being eaten by their fellow blacks when they lost a tribal war. At least, that was the case with most of the blacks in Rhodesia, where they worked primarily as farm laborers. But there was some resentment, some envy of the white man. And there were whites infected by the disease of liberalism who were eager to fuel that resentment and turn that envy into active hatred. Some of these infected whites were in the media. Even more of them were in the Christian churches. One of the principal activities of the Christian churches in Rhodesia was educating blacks. They set up mission schools throughout the country where they not only provided free medical care for the blacks and taught them how to read and write, but also pumped into them the propaganda of equality and of hatred of their white employers. They preached a theology of revolution. Every single black terrorist leader who later emerged when warfare between blacks and whites broke out in Rhodesia, everyone was trained in a Christian mission school. That includes the current black dictator of Zimbabwe, former terrorist leader, now president, Robert Gabriel Mugabe. It also includes the Reverend Nabingi Sithole, who in 1979 was the head of the Zimbabwe African National Union, ZANU, one of the principal terrorist groups, and it includes Bishop Abel Muzorewa, the first black to be maximum leader of Rhodesia after the whites abdicated. When black terrorists became active on a significant scale during the 1960s, the Rhodesians fought back hard. While other European colonies in Africa were abandoned, the Rhodesians, along with the South Africans, were determined to defend their land and their homes. And of course, the liberals in Europe and in America were solidly on the side of the black terrorists. The liberals cheered whenever the blacks murdered a white farm family or set off a terrorist bomb in Salisbury. And when the terrorists murdered or mutilated the black workers of a white farmer, the liberals were silent. They hadn't really wanted that, but after all, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. An ironic point is that Rhodesia's Christian missions also were frequent targets. The white farmers learned quickly how to deal with terrorists. Their farms were heavily armed, and they set up a very effective mutual defense and alarm network. When they caught a live terrorist, they hanged him. The Rhodesian army had the best anti-terrorist fighters in the world. Tracking, catching, and killing black terrorists became a sport at which they excelled. In their frustration, the blacks turned on the Christian missions which had trained them. The missions were unarmed and often were in remote areas, and so were easy targets. The blacks would gang rape the white nuns and nurses and then cut their throats. They would slit open the bellies of the white infants and children and pull out their entrails. They would impale the priests on stakes and gouge out their eyes. The liberals back in America would smirk. They would much rather it had been a white farm family than the white staff of a Christian mission station, but at least the victims were white. The Rhodesians, as a whole, were coping pretty well with black terrorism, so the liberals began applying economic terrorism. Rhodesia was placed under embargo by the United Nations. The intention was to starve the Rhodesian racists into submission, to cut off the supplies they needed to defend themselves from the black terrorists. Well, the embargo was ineffective because the Rhodesians got whatever they needed from the South Africans just across the Limpopo River to the south. This infuriated the liberals. Christian church groups in America raised money to send to the black terrorists in Rhodesia so that they could buy more effective weapons. Whenever the Rhodesians hanged a group of terrorists, church groups and other liberal groups in America would hold candlelight vigils, which seems to be one of the favorite things liberals do. The Jewish media were the most effective weapon of the liberals against Rhodesia, however. The media in America whipped up a frenzy of bloodthirsty hatred against the Rhodesians. They had students demonstrating on university campuses. They invited terrorist leaders to speak to student groups and helped raise funds for the terrorists. The destruction of white Rhodesia was one of the top priority projects of American liberals during the 1970s. But the white Rhodesians weren't especially worried. They had declared their independence from Britain in 1965 when the liberals in Britain tried to impose black rule on them. And as long as they could trade their farm products and their minerals to South Africa in return for military helicopters and petroleum products, they knew they could fight black terrorism indefinitely. So the liberals stepped up the economic pressure against South Africa. And the South Africans, I am embarrassed to say, eventually gave in. They cut off their trade with Rhodesia, leaving the Rhodesians isolated. And I cannot blame this bit of treachery entirely on the liberals. In part, it was due to selfishness and stupid short-sightedness on the part of non-liberal South Africans. South African businessmen and politicians thought that if they threw the Rhodesians to the wolves, they could relieve some of the economic pressure the liberals were putting on South Africa. Even without South Africa's help, the Rhodesians could deal with the terrorists. But liberalism also had infected many Rhodesians and weakened both their self-confidence and their judgment. They decided in 1979 that living under a black government wouldn't be so bad after all. Blacks were human beings too, they thought. Surely the blacks would understand that their own welfare depended on the whites. The whites made up only 4.5% of the population, but they produced 92% of Rhodesia's agricultural output. Black farmers engaged only in subsistence farming, and their own families consumed nearly everything they produced. Without the white farmers and their large, efficient farms, everything would sink back into the jungle. So, with all sorts of agreements and safeguards and assurances from the British government and the United Nations, the Rhodesians turned their government over to the black majority, thinking that then the world would love them. Their standard of living would go up because the embargo would be lifted and everything would be peaceful and prosperous again. Well, it didn't take long for cold, hard reality to assert itself. The first thing that happened was a change in the name of their country from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe. Their capital city had its name changed from Salisbury to Harare, and their democratic government, with all its checks and balances to assure the safety of the white minority, quickly reverted to the norm for black Africa, a one-party dictatorship with an increasingly unstable and unpredictable black dictator. Robert Mugabe's party controls 147 of the 150 seats in Zimbabwe's parliament. There are black opposition groups in Zimbabwe, but when they try to have public meetings or election rallies, they are set upon by armed thugs from Mugabe's party, and their leaders tend to disappear or have fatal accidents. During a peaceful march in Harare on the first of this month by 3,000 members of an opposition group, including 200 whites, Mugabe supporters armed with clubs and machetes attacked the marchers while black police watched without interfering. The attackers singled out the whites in the procession. I'll read you a few lines from an eyewitness report. I quote, "As the police stepped hastily aside, they charged. Demonstrators fled in panic as stones were hurled toward them. Crouching in a doorway, I saw an ordinary shopping street overrun by anarchy. Thugs raced along pavements, beating bystanders to the ground and snatching handbags. Shops hastily barricaded entrances, leaving desperate people trapped in the street. A white man in his 50s was hit by stones and fell to the ground. His companion, a white woman in her 40s, was toppled beside him. Seconds later, three youths attacked them with clubs, and blood spattered across the pavement where they lay. In front of me, I have dozens of other eyewitness reports of beatings, slashings, and stabbings of whites who participated in this peaceful protest against the Mugabe government 2 weeks ago. I doubt that you read any of these reports in the New York Times or the Washington Post. They really don't like to report such news. Much of the recent turmoil in Zimbabwe is related to Mugabe's threats during the past year to take their farms away from white farmers and give them to his black followers. Last week, on April 6th, he finally announced that he will confiscate white farms without compensation. Even before the announcement, black gangs already had invaded more than 800 white farms and become illegal squatters, and Mugabe had refused to intervene. There are only 75,000 whites left in Zimbabwe today. Of the 275,000 Rhodesians in the country in 1979 at the advent of black rule, 200,000 already have left. The ones who remain own some 4,500 farms, which still produce more than 90% of Zimbabwe's agricultural output. Mugabe is basing his popularity with blacks on a promise to take the farms away from whites and redistribute the land to blacks. Referring to his refusal to remove the illegal squatters from the white farms, Mugabe announced last week, and I quote, "We will not remove the people from the farms. We are going to share the farms. We are all equal. We all have to share equally." The remaining whites in Zimbabwe are desperate. Their farms are all they have. When those are taken, most of them will have nothing left and nowhere to go. A minority of them with British passports can go to Britain, but everything they own, everything they spent their lives building, will remain behind. Now, here's the punchline to this story. 4 days ago, on Tuesday night of this week, I saw a one-minute snippet about the dispossession of the white farmers of Zimbabwe on CNN headline news. I don't expect to see much more. So far as the Jewish media bosses are concerned, it's not important news. The victims are our people, not Jews or blacks or other non-whites, and so there's no need to make a fuss about it. And the liberals, of course, aren't interested. They were very interested back in the 1970s when they were busy destroying Rhodesia. But now that the work of destruction is done, they have completely lost interest. They don't care. Their latest project is to persuade the International Monetary Fund that it must not be so stingy in giving our money to African countries which need it. They're demonstrating in the streets of Washington right now in a campaign to get more money for supporting bankrupt countries, countries like Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe. Since the whites, who were the principal employers of black workers in Zimbabwe, began leaving a few years ago, the unemployment rate in Zimbabwe has reached 50%. Now the annual inflation rate also has reached 50%. When Mugabe begins grabbing more white farms, as he announced last week that he would, there will be a total collapse of the economy. On top of that, one in every five blacks in Zimbabwe is infected with HIV. Yes, indeed, a new generation of very earnest college girls and long-haired freaks and hymn-singing Christians soon will have a wonderful new cause to devote themselves to, providing money and food and medical aid to the starving, AIDS-wasted blacks of Zimbabwe. They will be demonstrating just as self-righteously for this cause as the previous generation demonstrated for black rule in Rhodesia. You know, I started out today to talk about the disease of liberalism. What I've talked about so far is just one of the consequences of liberalism, one of the effects of this disease of the soul. The very earnest college girls and the long-haired freaks and hymn-singing Christians who were so proud of themselves when they succeeded in destroying Rhodesia are just an effect of liberalism also. They aren't liberals. They don't have an ideology. They just want to be fashionable. They will take up any cause with the utmost earnestness so long as it is fashionable. They don't have the wits to understand the disastrous consequences of their misdirected earnestness, and they really don't care. I used to want to kill all of these people. I wanted to round up every earnest college girl and every long-haired freak and every hand-clapping hymn singer who had demonstrated for black rule in Rhodesia, or for a boycott of South Africa, or for black voting rights in the South, or what have you, make them dig an enormous burial pit and then machine gun all of them. I wanted to obtain all of the old membership lists of the organizations to which these people had belonged so that they could all be rounded up and done away with. They have done so much damage in this world and then walked away from it without the least regard for what they've done, without the least understanding of the harm they've caused, that it seemed to me that the proper thing to do was just kill them all. Well, I understand now that that's not really necessary. There are just too many trendy idiots in the world. They are not even inherently evil. They lack the ability to distinguish good from evil. They have no more inherent morality than animals do. They have no souls. They have only the ability to recognize what is trendy at the moment. The people who need to be killed are the ones who set the destructive trends for the idiots. They are the real liberals, the ones who are really sick and need to be put down. I'll talk more about them later. But for now, I must tell you, I am really heartbroken when I contemplate what the destructive idiots they manipulate have done to the white people of Rhodesia, who were among the finest of our people, and who at this moment are facing a very grim future indeed. Thanks for being with me again today.